Let me tell you my good news. Mine started long time ago. This date is stuck in my memory banks and will be, I guess, until I'm struck by some disease that keeps me from remembering it, or the Lord calls me home, and even if I go to heaven, I'm going to remember the date. On July the 28th, 1978. Now, immediately, most of you are going, I wasn't even alive then. When were you born, Abigail? What year?
84.
That's sad, isn't it? Dana, what year were you born?
86.
I've got socks older than you. You were born in 78? Okay. Okay, this is my story. I don't want to hear all this. Bunch of heathens. I was 42 back then. Yeah.
That was great.
You're not sorry. You meant to do it. Don't be lying in church. Anyway, July the 28th, 1978 was one of those dates that stuck in my memory for this reason particularly. I was living in Ohio at the time. I had been in Ohio for a little over 6-7 months working as a youth minister. That's back when I was a real preacher. And I'd worked with that group of kids at that church for 6 months or so, and just nothing was happening. I wasn't seeing any kind of progress, wasn't seeing any kind of changes, or that I was having any effect. And I wasn't blaming God, and I wasn't blaming those kids. I was just figured, okay, this little old country boy was in over his head in that big city church type stuff. And I had a church down here in close to Lubbock. In fact, it was Sudan. My hometown church had called me and asked me to come. They were looking to hire a youth minister, and I was going to go. I went down and talked to them, and we talked about me coming back. And I was telling them, I said, I probably will, because, I mean, nothing's happening in Ohio. I'm just not able to reach those kids. We went off, but before I had a commitment to go to a camp. And we went off to camp with a bunch of kids. And one night, and I don't remember what night it was, but it was July the 28th. And we walked out of our little chapel service that we had at the evening. And I'm walking back toward the barracks where all the guys were. And I noticed a couple of young ladies down, teenage girls, sitting down by the lake. And it was obvious that they were kind of crying. They were upset and stuff. And I had one of those defining moments in your life. I started to walk past, because here's what I thought. I thought, I don't want to bother them. I mean, they're having a personal, private moment, and I don't want to bother them. I believe it was the Lord that laid it on my heart, said, no, they may need something, and if they don't need something, then you can go, but at least stop and offer. Well, I stopped, and we started talking, and they started asking questions, and we started reading our Bibles, and we started talking about Jesus. And I had just got through reading and laying the words of Psalms 18 that we're going to study tonight. I'd laid it up in my heart, and we were talking about God and how He feels about us and stuff. And I shared with them those two girls and then the collection of people that gathered around while we were talking. And those two girls decided that night to make the decision to follow Jesus. So I baptized them in that lake. And that was, July 27th is when I saw them. July 28th is when they finally were born into God's family. And those two girls, I watched God work through them, transform an entire, not just youth group, but an entire church. So much so that churches around our church were affected by this particular group of young people. It was remarkable. I don't know if you've ever seen anything like it. Well, one of those girls graduated from high school. One of those girls came to the AIM program down here in Lubbock and went to Africa. And while in Africa, her and her team met a young lady named Jackie, who was from Africa. She came back to the AIM program, went to Portugal. Then when she was finished in Portugal, she went back to Africa. And she's still in Africa and teaching and doing wondrous things there. That's just a little bit of the ripple. But one of those young ladies is here tonight. I made a point of calling her. I call her or email her every July the 28th because I remember not only that that's the beginning of her new life in Jesus, it was the beginning moment, honest, it was really the beginning moment of understanding for me the power of God's Word can have on people whose hearts are open. And so I want you to meet Barbara Smith. And I'm going to have her stand up. This is my daughter in faith. The very first. She was, Romans 16 will talk about the first fruits in Asia. She was the first fruit of God for my work in Ohio. After what happened that weekend and at that camp, I called the church in Sudan and said, I can't leave because there's something happening here and I don't know what it is. I had nothing to do with it. I just watched it in amazement. And Barbara and that other girl and the young folks that were there transformed that church and changed lives, not just in that place, but around the world. Now, Barbara, and when she was in Africa, she was with a guy on her AIM team named Chris. They came back here and got married, which was after AIM. Yeah. They got married after they came back here and started having babies and doing good things and did mission work and just they've done a great and good work, and now they're back working with the AIM program. And I wanted them to be here tonight to meet you. But the good thing that I see is God is still working a good thing from a moment in time when I started to say, no, I won't bother because they don't want me to bother them. And that's too many times that's what we say. We don't want, they won't want us to bother them. They won't want us to say anything. You override that to do what you know is right, what you know is good. Even if you get rejected, you still did what was right. And thank God in that case I didn't get rejected and God didn't get rejected. And God is still doing amazing things. They had two children and I've got stories after stories of those two kids. Because one of the fun things about this is Barbara babysat my children. She babysat David and Sherry when they were little bitty. And then when Sherry got a little bit grown up and they started having babies, my daughter got to babysit their children. They didn't trust David, but they trusted Sherry. But I have some great and good stories about Amy, and I promised her I wouldn't tell you tonight. Come next week, we'll talk, all right? But it was coincidence. I had scheduled for us to study Psalms 18 tonight. That was the psalm that I used to teach those kids that night at that lake. And the power of these words, I think, are seen in the power of God working in their lives still. But maybe it'll do the same for us, okay? You got your Bible to Psalms 18? This is a song that David sang after God delivered him from the hand of his enemies and from the hand of Saul. I don't know if we understand the import of those words. When I have struggled, when I've gone through rough times, when God has delivered me, you know what sometimes we still talk about? Is the tough times. We'll talk about the people that we still blame for those tough times. And don't tell me we don't, okay? I love you, but I know you. I hear our conversations. I sometimes share in those conversations with you. We'll focus on the people we blame. We want to talk about the drama. We want to talk about the people we blame. We want to talk about the problem, the troublemakers. What David did was he turned around and sang this song to the Lord when the Lord had delivered him. So when God has done something in your life, and we'll exercise in a minute and talk about those things, when God has done something wonderful in your life, rather than focusing on where you were and who's to blame for where you were, why not just take a minute and thank God? He said, I love you, Jehovah. Now, I'm going to quote and read at the same time. I laid these words up a long time ago in my old Bible, in my real Bible. This version I didn't recognize back in those days, but he said, I love you, Jehovah. my rock, my fortress, my deliverer, my God, in whom I'll take refuge. I will call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised, and I will be saved from my enemies. Now look at verse 3. Remember the song? I will call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be saved from my enemies. The Lord liveth, and blessed be the rock, and let the God of my salvation be exalted. The Lord liveth, and blessed be the rock, and let the God of my salvation be exalted. I will call upon the Lord. The man who wrote that song found those words here and tried to express them with his words and God's words. Great song. Great song. There's other songs written from this psalm. They won't be sung in here, but they are sung in places, in hearts of people all over the world. Verse 4 is where we want to focus. The cords of death entangle me. The torrents of destruction overwhelm me. The cords of the grave coiled around me, and the snares of death confronted me. Now stop. Just stop right there. I've got to tell you, when I was... How old was I in 78?
42.
Nobody asked either one of y'all to answer. But I was not 42. What? Let's see. I was 26. I can't do the math in my head, but I was 26 years old. I was 26 years old, and I remember memorizing these verses. I remember discussing these verses with people. I remember teaching these verses, and I had no idea what they meant. I could tell you from David's life, man, Saul was chasing him all over like a wild animal trying to kill him. And when he faced Goliath, Goliath was not going to invite him home for supper. He was going to pull his head off and yodel down his throat, right? Philistines and Saul and Amalekites and Jebusites and all those other parasites were going to hurt him, and he understood something real serious about life and death. At 26 years old, I had not a clue, okay? I had not a clue. I felt guilt for some of my sins. I felt fear about some of my dreads of the future, but I knew nothing about the cords of death entangling me. I knew nothing about the cords of death surrounding me and drowning me and overwhelming me. I knew none of that. That was all theory. Now, since then, my own sin, my own shame has put me in some situations where I have a little bit better understanding of that. And there's some of us sitting in this room that have been there. Some of us, and I know us, some of us have seen guns pointed at us. Some have seen judges drop the gavel on us. Some of us have been in places that we won't discuss in church or in places around nice people because they can't imagine those kind of places. When I was 26, I didn't have a clue. I have a little bit better clue now. But I want you, and then I'm going to ask my son, we're going to do some of this together. You tell me. Tell me about the cords of death. Tell me, when were you in this place? When were you overwhelmed? Now, I know we've got visitors. I know we've got visitors. You just got to relax. We've got to be ourselves. If we're going to do this, if we're going to do it right, we've got to be open. We've got to be honest about it. So go ahead like we usually do. Tell me, when were you in this place? When were you overwhelmed?
Mine was not too long ago, and I was so overwhelmed with anxiety that I was begging the Lord to take me because I couldn't do it anymore.
If you're visiting here, and you may have heard somebody say something like that sometime, but to say begging my Lord to take me, that's not spiritualized. That's real. That's agony. That's saying, God, I want to go. I want out. Take me out. I remember screaming. Didn't care if he sent me to hell. At least that was my torment then. Just get me out of this world. Get me out of the torment of this world. Where you been? Where were you when you were overwhelmed? What was it that overwhelmed you? What was it that put you at the point that you thought the snares of death confronted you?
I guess when I felt the worst and I really wanted to just ask God to take me was when I actually sat there and I watched somebody help me shoot up drugs. And I promised myself I would never do something like that ever. And it would be the last thing on earth that I would do. And when I felt so depressed and so sad and so helpless that I thought that was the only way to feel anything, because I didn't really feel either. You know, it was really empty and cold and dark. And that's when I thought, this is it, because I know from here there's no way but down.
What do you think the torrents of destruction feel like? Cold? Dark? Empty? Where were you when you were overwhelmed? What was it that happened? What was it that put you in this place?
My father passed away May 5th. He took his life. And I kind of went through a phase that thinking drinking was going to solve everything. I couldn't get to the bottom of the glass, and it wasn't. I had to put my heart and soul into my father.
Yeah.
That's what I did.
What was it that overwhelmed you? What was it that put you in this place?
When my husband left me, and I felt that I couldn't go on, I didn't know how I was going to raise my kids and survive. I just thought it was the end of the world. I thought, I don't want to be here anymore. I don't want to go through this.
What overwhelmed you?
My abusive marriage was at its worst, and I couldn't see any way out. Didn't know what I was going to do to get out. So,
in those things, and then the things that still haven't been spoken, you notice some of those things were circumstances that you couldn't control. That you had to face, you suffered because of somebody else's struggle. You suffered because of somebody else's decision. Some of us put ourselves in that place. That's what I did. I put myself in that place. I put myself in that torment, in that overwhelming place. Did you notice what people did? Some wanted to give up. Some begged God to take them. Some turn to drugs, some turn to drink. I'm going to let David do some talking here and talk about that flood overwhelming us and then some of the choices we make.
First of all, I want to say I'm glad Dad clarified the thing about the date, because now I know why he texts me every Wednesday. Those times that we've been in that pit, it forces us to have such desperate perspectives, desperate reactions, and we usually choose. What? And I didn't say mine a minute ago. I tell you, one of the things that comes to my mind when I read that, people that I thought were supposed to be good people who were people I thought I could depend on and that loved me, and I found out they didn't. That'd be my part of that pit sometimes. When that happens, those things that we choose, we know it's not really the answer, but why do we still go ahead and make that choice? Do what? It gives you a little bit of relief. And relief viewed how? And we view that relief how? And it's really funny because it's not really relief. It's interesting what was said. I tried to get to the bottom of the glass, but when you get there, and I've heard all kinds of people that have struggled with that kind of situation, they get there, and what's still there? It's not relief. It's just something different. Now, most of the time, and I'm glad that you're here. You recognize me without my suit and tie on? Okay. She sees me normally in a different setting, so sometimes folks don't recognize. It's nice to have another counselor in the room because we see folks go through all these things. All of those things that you were doing, what was it meant to be? The word, a distraction. But all of these things that you were doing, whether it's saying, take me, whether it was drinking, whether it was shooting up, whether it was fighting, whether it was eating, whether it was sleeping all the time or not sleeping all the time or starving yourself, all of that was meant to do what?
Kills the pain.
But it's also meant how else?
Escape.
What else is it meant to do?
Have some control.
What else? I have somebody that comes in my office and starts talking about any and all of these things. I understand the destructive nature of it. I understand the unwise spiritual aspects of it. But what is it? We know this in another sense. Do what?
They need to turn to God.
But all of these things, how would we see them? Now put it in the counselor's seat. Somebody acts out in a certain way, what am I going to look at it as? They really want to take their life?
No.
Desperation. There's the word. It's a cry for help. What does David do here?
He cries for help.
Now, some of these things that we do, the choices that we make and the reactions that we make, bad things, some of them sinful things, yes, but in another perspective, what maybe should we understand about it? What were we really trying to do? Cry for help somehow. We just didn't know how to do it. Young lady cuts herself. Not a lot of people know about it. She really trying to hurt herself? No. It's a cry for help. This person turns to this substance, or this person goes this direction with things. We make those choices. That flood overtakes us. And when it overtakes you, you don't feel like you can do anything but do what? Just roll with it and get bulldozed. I so much like the fact, and I don't know whether we're going to have time to cover the whole thing tonight, but don't stop in the middle of this psalm. Read the whole thing. Because David is making a choice despite what he feels. And what he feels is horrible. And the horrible things that you felt when you were in that pit, I completely understand. I've been there. I felt them often and frequently and recently. But he still cries out for help. Do we need to maybe cry a different way than we're crying? Sometimes maybe. Does God, I think, maybe understand some of that? Probably so. One of the things that really gets me about this is he'll say that the Lord has dealt with me according to my righteousness. That's interesting, because it says this psalm is attributed to the time when he was delivered from the hand of Saul. So maybe you could say there's not a whole lot of the bad things that we know about David that have happened yet. But it's still funny someone talks about their own righteousness before God. Didn't mean David was perfect, but meant God had seen him how? Had understood him to be what? Righteous from his perspective. When you felt the way you did you feel that way? Do you feel that way? Do you feel that way? We don't, do we? Miserable, horrible, the flood overtakes me, I can't stand it, I don't know what to do about it. And so we'll cry one way or the other. The thing we have to see is when David cried, where did he cry to? All of these cries were a cry in some direction. maybe understandable, still some of them not the best, still even if they weren't sinful, not necessarily pointed in the right direction. Guess what? Do that too. Done it 1,000 times. And he says, I cried to him. Why don't we cry to him first normally?
We think that we don't deserve
that. We think we don't deserve it. What else would you put with that? Do what?
Why would he listen to me?
Why would he listen to me? Why else? We want something very tangible. Somebody that I can get the hold of, that I can really see, or if nothing less, here on the other end of the phone. Because at least if I know them well enough to think I can call them, I can at least imagine what the sound of their voice is like. But we get ashamed, we get afraid, we get scared. And it's one thing, like you said, if you're having to suffer because of somebody else, that may not as be a big a factor. But if you've kind of caused some of your own trouble, don't you feel kind of double ashamed, double scared, double worried?
David, I played like I could hide from him.
How'd that work out?
But that's what I was doing.
Yeah.
I remember. Just don't look for a while, okay? Leave me alone.
Don't, yeah, just don't look for me. Don't come after me. I think I can hide for a little while. It overwhelms us. We make that choice. Now, the idea is that we still do what? We cry. Now, let's cry towards the right direction. Let's cry to the right entity. Let's understand the impact of those choices and what's going on with that flood. And we cry to God, and obviously, and he's going to get to expound on this further. We know we cry to God. We know, not how we feel, but what do we know God's going to do? How many verses talk about ask and you will receive, seek and you'll find, ask and your prayer is going to be answered? If you ask according to his purpose, you can be sure that he's going to give it to you. He's going to take care of you. We make those choices out of desperation. And we cry in our certain ways. We've got to understand where David understood to cry to. During the course of what had happened, had some of his own supposed friends turned on him? Yep. Had he been worn out, weary, pressed, nearly gotten a few times? Did other people have to suffer because of his running and his hiding? Yeah. A whole bunch of folks get slayed. And all in all, he realized who was going to come get him. God was. And does God mind? No, he doesn't. Look at verse 6. While you're finding verse 6, let's walk through some of these things. Did David ever feel so anxious that he begged God to take him? Now read the Psalms. It'd be good exercise. Read them out loud and you'll hear your voice expressing his heart that was inspired by God. Did David ever see the loss of anyone he loved? Yeah, several times. Did David ever face the betrayal of friends and suffer because of the consequences of people he thought he could trust turning against him? Yeah. Did David ever commit a sin so shameful that it became known not just all over the world, their world, but for all time? Yeah, he did. He understands, doesn't he? And what did he do in his distress? Look at verse 6. In my distress, I
call to the Lord. See, it's too simple. I know it's too simple. And we just don't think, well, that's just not enough. Okay, I understand. But you know what's the most basic? It is the most fundamental basic response to distress. You learned it as kids. I cannot read that phrase without thinking about this boy. Somebody, somewhere we were when he was a little guy, he went with me everywhere, but he jumped out of the car, some farmhouse we were. He jumped out of the car, ran around the car to get to me, and a big dog that could look him in the eye barked right in his face. Scared him, and for a long time after that, then if there was any dogs around anywhere, he didn't want to have anything to do with them, you know. He would never have admitted being afraid of dogs, and I would never say it publicly. But he had an aversion, a deep aversion to dogs. Well, my parents live way out in the country. It is his favorite place in the world. His favorite place in the world is out at the farm with my mom and dad, Big Bill and Granny JoJo. I'd take him out there. They used to inherit. People would just drop dogs off their house. They didn't want to keep them. They'd give them to them. My mom and dad would take care of them. There was an old sort of collie mixed breed dog. They named him Star. About the best thing about that dog is he knew how to eat. As the dumbest dog I know, but he knew how to eat. But that dog was pretty big, hairy, and lots of teeth. David and I went out there to see my folks one day, and he jumped out of the car, just like always, ran up to see his grandma and grandpa. And when Star heard a little kid's voice, Star was way off out in the farm field, way off, and he heard David yelling for his Big Bill. And so Star started running. Well, David spotted him. And David started being real tough. Star! No, no, no. Taking control over a situation, you know, he could. And Star saw him pointing his finger and waving his arm, and he thought he wants to play. So Star starts running faster. And of course, his tongue's hanging out, his teeth are showing, his tongue is wagging. The tail himself of this dog was big enough to hurt him. So Star starts running faster. David sees that he's running faster, understands the consequence of that, so he starts running. Well, the moment he starts running, Star thinks, ooh, he really wants to play, so he starts running faster. Tongue hanging out, teeth dripping with saliva, and his tail whipping back and forth. And David finally starts backing up, and there's a place at that house where you can kind of get in the corner, and he backs up and he's throwing rocks or anything. Star, go away. Well, now he's playing fetch, right? So Star gets running faster and faster, barking, and he's licking him, and he's drooling, and he's ready to play. And finally, David's throwing, and he's acting tough, and he's throwing, but he's backing up, and finally gets pinned up where he can't go anywhere, and he goes, Daddy! And all of a sudden, all of that image disappeared. All of that posturing disappeared. And it got down to the most fundamental reaction that God placed in all of us. When you get in a bind, what do you do? Daddy! That's what David did. He cried. We have gotten so mature and so spiritual. Notice your voice is supposed to go deeper when you say spiritual. We've gotten so spiritual, we've gotten so mature, and we've gotten so calloused to real honest feelings about the Lord. We've stopped seeing just the most fundamental reaction is, you get in a bind, holler. You get in a bind, cry. Now here's the good thing about it. The good thing about it is how He responds when you cry. When you cry, He comes. It's just automatic. I wish we had old Bibles, because the NIV leaves it out. But there's one word missing at the next. When David calls and God hears him, there is a word missing in the NIV that's there in lots of other Bibles. But it is the word that's always there when you cry to a Father who loves you. When you cry to a God who made you. You know what the word is? I'll give you an example. Elijah Remember the story of Elijah, Mount Carmel? They're going to face the prophets of Baal, and the prophets of Baal build their altar, and they dance around it, cut themselves like Baal ears, and Baal won't hear them, right? And then Elijah said, it's my turn. So he scrapes their altar out of the way, big old ditch, puts 12 stones down, builds the altar, puts a bull on it, pours 12 barrels of water on top of it till it fills the ditch. And then he says, God, you're the God of Israel, of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Would you let these folks know that I'm your servant today? And then he kind of scooted over, I bet. You know what the next word in the text is? Then. When you cry to a living God, then. Dad, don't read it. Don't read it. Just enjoy the picture. It's a picture. Just enjoy it. Back in the old days, I could have quoted it, but I got two versions in my brain and I'd mess it up. Then the earth shook and trembled and the foundations of the mountain quaked and were shaken because he was angry. Smoke rose up out of his nose and fire came out of his mouth. He bowed the heavens also and came down. He soared on the wings of the wind. He mounted the cherubim and flew. He soared on the wings of the wind. He made darkness his hiding place, a pavilion round about him. Darkness of waters, thick clouds of the sky. At the brightness of his presence, the clouds disappeared. The Lord thundered in the heavens, and the voice high of the Most High thundered, and he shot arrows out and scattered them, lightnings manifold, and discomforted them. The valleys of the sea were exposed, and the foundations of the earth were laid bare. At your rebuke, O Jehovah, at the blast of your nostrils, he reached down from on high and took me, and drew me out of deep waters. He rescued me from my powerful enemy, and from my foes who were too strong for me. And we'll stop there for a second. Did you see the picture? I wish I could sing it like I used to, but I'm telling you, do you see the picture? The only time you read of God Almighty standing up off His throne is when He is coming to take care of you by taking care of your enemies. When you cry, you may not can see it. You may not even be able to sense it, but the moment you cry, whether it's that anguished cry, God come and get me, or it's that silent heart cry and pillow in the middle of the night, God help me, He hears you. And because He hears you, He comes. He gets off His throne. And I love the picture. You love the picture? He, one of those cherubim, you know, those six-winged things, you know, in the Bible? He calls one of them for a ride. He straddles that one and heads toward the earth because somebody's messing with his son. Somebody's messing with his daughter. And he surrounds himself in clouds so the enemy can't see him coming. Now, of course, there's lots of racket, lots of thunder, lots of lightning, so I suspect the enemy's getting the idea, I shouldn't have messed with this kid. And as he gets close, man, he's so bright the clouds pass away and God is right there and he reaches down and snatches me and he says, he put me in a safe place. He delivered me from my strong enemy. Is there any other kind? Is there any other kind of enemy? An enemy that's weak is no enemy, right? I'll kick them, right? I can win. I beat them. My strong enemy are those things that keep wearing me out over and over again. Now, at 26 years old, I would have said, I have no real strong enemies. I have no strong enemies except those enemies that were inside me. So I went to looking. I went to looking at all the enemies. I went to looking at all the enemies that David faced in his life. You remember one of the first enemies David faced?
Bear.
A bear and a lion. You got a bear inside you? Anybody in here ever have to deal with the bear of lust that takes what it wants, when it wants, and regardless of the consequences? How about a lion? Anybody got a lion of pride in you? Where it's hard for you to admit that you were wrong, where it's hard to admit that you were the one that made the mistake and caused the trouble in the first place and need to fix it. Saul was one of his enemies. Anybody got in your heart, you got a Saul of jealousy? I don't know many things more destructive than jealousy. Because jealousy will cause you to think that you're justified in feeling it. And all the while it is a selfish, destructive, damaging emotion. Anybody got a Goliath of fear in them? You're afraid to try to do what's right? I know folks all the time that tell themselves they cannot make the choice to do what's right for themselves or for their family because, well, it's just too hard. I'm afraid of what would happen. You facing a Goliath of fear, a lion of pride, a bear of lust, a Saul of jealousy? You cry, God hears. But we got some other enemies. Let's say them, and then I'm going to turn this over to David. Let him say a word or that, and then we'll finish this off. Tell me your enemy.
I think sometimes my enemy is because I know God and I know His Word, and then when I turn to God, so I can't call God because I deserve
what I get. You can't call on God because you deserve what you're getting. That's how we feel, isn't it? Did David deserve what he was getting? In some of these cases, he was. And what did he still teach us? Especially when you've done it. Especially when you don't deserve God. That's when you need Him most. What's your enemy? What's your enemy? Let's be real specific, personal. What's your enemy? Laziness. What's your enemy?
Selfishness.
Selfishness. What's your enemy?
Jealousy.
What's your enemy?
I think you're good enough.
Feeling that unworthy. What's your enemy?
I have a number, but fear. I live for about a month and a half in fear that I would be kicked out of China because I was a Christian this year. And it stopped me for a month and a half until I finally said, no, I couldn't do this. Yeah.
What's your enemy? Anger. Anybody have any trouble with bitterness? Anybody have any trouble with lust? Nah, we don't ever talk about that, church. Anybody have any trouble with anxiety? Anybody got any trouble with guilt? What else, Dave? What are the enemies?
There are lots of enemies that we face. And the fun thing about Scripture is it's not just limited to David. You see Abraham go through it. You see Balaam go through it. You see the prophets go through it. You see disciples go through it. You see all kinds of folks go through enemies. Enemies that attack. Enemies that will just pick. Sometimes it's your own. It's your own guilt. It's your own laziness. It's your own fear. It's your own selfishness. It's your own stubbornness. Other times, it's those people that you can't fix. And those situations that you can't change. I was reminded about my own experiences with that type of an enemy this week. Y'all figured out by now, I'm kind of into sports. Opportunity came up in Plains this year to actually do some special work with some of the high school seniors. We've got the potential to really make a run at maybe going to a state championship game, at least being in the regional finals kind of thing. There's one kid, though, that hadn't really been involved. He decided actually not to play last year. Hadn't really been involved in summer workouts. We've been trying to get, encouraged to come in. And I finally got a chance to talk to the kid one-on-one and said, what's the problem? I know this is your thing. This is what you love to do. And he had all these frustrations about how he'd seen others handle their level of seriousness and dedication and commitment to certain things. And so he said, what's the use? I decided, why bother? And sometimes our enemy is that kind of a thing. Well, they ain't doing it right. And that old man taught me the best lesson about that. I've never been one for a whole lot of hypocritical stuff, especially in certain situations that I experienced in my life. And I've told y'all before, there was a period in my time the least trustworthy and the least people I thought of any value of were church people because of some bad experiences. And I can remember being quite frustrated about those, and I kind of thought, like this kid, what's the use and why bother? Until he taught me, well, that's all fine and dandy, but do you want to end up going to hell with those people? Good point. I was like, oh yeah. And it's one of those moments, I hate that, you know. He's right. That I wasn't going to say it. Somebody else did it for me. Yes, I didn't have to say it. Those are our enemies. And then the bad thing about it is, once something becomes an enemy to us, there are lots of people that are indifferent to you, right? Indifferent people, guess what? Care less. Guy today makes a point to whistle at me and driving him while I'm driving in my truck. He's over in his truck. He makes a point to give me a guns up. Tech fans, Florida State fans don't care about you. You ain't won a national championship. I said, hey, win a ring first. Rolled up my window, didn't care. Indifferent. But somebody becomes an enemy. I know how my system works. Somebody becomes an enemy, and what does that mean?
The game's on.
Do what?
The game is on.
The game is on. Even if what? I'm scared of them. And there's no good that comes out of that situation just on our own. There are all these different enemies that we have. Some of our own creation, some of others. We have all these different ways to choose from them. And guess what you find out God says? What David says about all this? He's scared, worn out about his enemies in the first part of the book. Yeah? You'll find that he ended up saying, verse 30, as for God, His way is perfect. And he talks about some things about God, again, as His shield and His refuge. But then he'll talk about how it's God that arms him and makes his feet swift like the deer's, trains his hands for battle. You broaden the path beneath me. And then you see David turn around and say what? I pursued my enemies. Our enemies scare us. Our enemies weaken us. Our enemies hurt us. Until we get God to help us fight them. And the first thing that we've already seen, what's God going to do? When I need that relief, when I need that safe place or that spacious place, guess what God's going to do? Pick me up, put me in that place, and let me breathe. Then what is He going to do? And used to, that was the end of the thought for me in this psalm, to be real honest with you. I kind of liked the first part and just stopped there. I forgot to read the rest. And I was just happy to be in the spacious place. Does that mean the enemies go away?
No.
They don't. But now who's he fighting with? He says, well, it's the Lord that's training me. It's the Lord that's arming me. And I'm going back to do what? I'm going back to go fight. And there may be different ways, and some of the different things we mentioned of different ways you have to fight it. The point is, you still got to do what? Fight. But who is fighting? God is. Who is still watching out over? And he's right. That dog was the vicious, horrible, worst dog in the whole world. I always kept an eyeball on that dog. As soon as he said that dog's name, I told Sherry I hated that dog. Hey, I hate, and I told y'all before, hate is a strong word. I literally, in that sense, hated that dog. I do remember that dog. I was little, but it didn't made an impression on me. Dog was of no good. At some point, what have you got to do? You know that verse in James says, resist the devil, he will flee from you. What does the first part of that verse say? What? What's the first phrase say? Do what? Nope. We don't, and this is funny because we don't know this. We know that verse, but we don't know how that verse starts. It says, submit yourself then to God. David knows he can't go fight on his own. He's overwhelmed. He has to cry out. Not just, hey God, could you come along when you got time? It's, Daddy! Come get me. And he receives the rescue. He receives the time to recuperate. And he understands that at some point there's another time for him to go fight again. But this time he's armed a little bit differently. And he's not so much in the same condition that he will be overwhelmed the same way. A lot of these things that we mentioned affect us what? And to such a degree that anything, if anybody even starts talking about that serious situation that almost swallowed us up, how do we start to feel? I even did it sitting here about that stupid dog that's been dead 20-something years. He mentioned Star, and I had this psychological chain reaction in me. Do what? I hate that dog. And actually, technically, it was my cousin's dog, but it stayed with us. He does that. God does that for us. He rescues us. He retrains us. He continues to go with us. Now, all of that is because of, I guess, what you left out a minute ago, which I knew to say for him, best for last. Look at verse 19, and we'll just tie the knot and be done. Verse 19. If you can hold on to nothing else, hold on to this one. He rescued you. I love the way my old Bible said it. He delivered you because. Underline the word, circle it, memorize it, sing it. He delivered you not because you deserved it. He delivered you not because you were going to be worth it in the long run. He delivered you because he delighted in you. If we had time, we'd just talk about things we delight in and take all those definitions and put them right back into the verse. I grew up being taught that God loved me. And I heard it with such regularity that I made the mistake of just hearing it and not accepting it. Jesus loves me. This I know, for the Bible tells me so. I had it down. Ask me that on any test, I'd answer it correctly. Didn't miss it. But I had no idea He delighted in me. I think that was the key. It what sparked the love of God in Barbara's heart and in Jane's heart and Mary Ann's and Mike's and Sarah's. Well, there's so many others up there. Jana. Those kids were changed because they were able to understand, accept, believe God delights in them. There's some of us in here that not many folks like. Now there's some of you that have never done anything wrong and people love you. And I'm one of them. I love you too. But there's some of us in here who know what it's like to be not liked by people.
There are people, we know, there are people that do not like us, and they, in case we forgot it, they would remind us, right? And that hurts my feelings sometimes, and it makes me sad sometimes, but it never takes away this truth. You don't like me? Man, I'll hate that. But God delights in me. You don't like me? You don't want me around? That'll make me sad. I promise. It'll make me sad. Make me sick in my stomach. It'll put a knot in my belly. And it'll make it hard for me to breathe. But God delights in me. So you don't? I hate that. But take it up with God. Because He delights in me. Man, if there was anything I wanted to give those kids back in 78 or give us tonight, is this thought from God. I don't know what your enemies are. I do, but I'll say it that way. I don't know all your enemies. I don't know all the ways that you've tried to overcome those enemies or escape those enemies or distract yourself from those enemies. But I know this. One thing is true, if nothing else is true. He delights in you. Hold on to that. Whether anybody else does or not, God delights in you. Let's let the song one more time be, and it'll be our prayer. I will call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be saved from my enemy. The Lord liveth, and blessed be the rock, and let the God of my salvation be exalted. You know the Lord liveth, and blessed be the rock, and let the God of my salvation be exalted. I will call upon the Lord.